Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island since 1988. Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find 312 Wheat Ale, Big Juicy Beer Hug, and so many other limited releases at either of Goose's locations in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free.
Hello, Chicago!
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking about great songwriting, including a conversation with the legendary duo Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll also talk with Ryan Tedder of One Republic, who has also written songs for Beyoncé, Adele, and more. But first, some new music from Killer Mike.
I remember you called and said, Michael, I am pregnant. I responded, baby girl, a baby girl might be a blessing. And I ain't Usher, baby, but this here is my confession. I must own it, I didn't want it, even now I know I'm flexing. Cause all that raw dog essence, and I knew I would get you pregnant. And all this teenage love is really just about possessing. They call it adolescence, cause we learning adult lessons. And I ain't grown because I roll some stones and carry weapons. I was rubbing on your tummy when your mommy asked for money. Told me your procedure's money. And she gon' need like 400. And had I known your mother wasn't gon' never let you keep it, I wouldn't have told my partners, would have kept that news a secret.
That is Slummer from the new Killer Mike album, Michael. It is named after Michael Render, a.k.a. Killer Mike.
You have to love that cute little picture of him as a kid.
Very nice. He looks so innocent in that that album cover, right? That's the sixth solo album for Killer Mike. But his first since 2012. He was a little busy between then and now.
A little bit.
Started a little one-off project with his producing partner LP, who produced his previous, whose last previous solo record, called Run the Jewels, and it was supposed to be a one-off, and you know, nothing, just a little side project that turned into this gigantic thing. They became a huge hip-hop duo, headlining arenas. That they went through four albums that got increasingly greater critical acclaim as well as commercial success.
And still they had time to appear on our show for a live performance and a wonderful chat.
They did. What a couple of great guys that we've known for a long time. And, you know, Killer Mike started his career as a regular on Outkast Records. Mm-hmm. They loved him, too, early on. He, you know, his debut, he hit a verse on the 2000 record for Outkast, and next thing you know, people are paying attention to him. His first solo record, Monster, in 2003, was pretty successful.
Yeah.
Went top 10 on the Billboard 200. And featured that single Adidas, which still to this day is his biggest commercial success as a single release. But subsequent records that didn't do as well, he was viewed as sort of an underground hip-hop artist.
Mm-hmm.
The collaboration with LP in 2012, at the time it was sort of viewed as like, man, how are these two guys working together? You know, we got this Brooklyn guy, LP.
Who was very underground.
Very underground. And you got this Dirty South guy and Killer Mike. How were they going to collaborate? Well, it turned out to be one of the best albums of 2012 and led to the subsequent collaboration with Run the Jewels. Now Killer Mike's resuming his solo career. LP's still on the record. No reason to panic. It seems like Run the Jewels is still a going concern. But here's this record, Michael, that we have from Killer Mike. And it was executive produced, by one, no ID.
Great.
He has a track record working with everyone from Common to Jay-Z, one of the great producers of the last 30 years. Let's play a track from the new record. It's called Motherless from Killer Mike on Sound Opinions.
My mama did, her mama did, her mama died in my arms. Mama said it wasn't fair. Her mama raised, I told her she crazy. She told me one day I'm gonna be gone, Michael, you gonna see. That my mama wanted you, but you belong to me.
Amen.
And you don't understand the sacrifice that took from me.
Amen.
Like pulling up on Sunday night just to tell you why I apologize. And mama, you was right.
Amen.
Like a hole in my heart, and I wanna call the Lord, but I don't know where to start.
You used to pray for me.
My mama did, my grandmama did.
That was Motherless, a track from the sixth solo album by Killer Mike called simply Michael. I'm glad we played that track, Greg, because it's about coping, Michael Render coping with the loss of both his mother and his grandmother, what they meant to him in his life. He has sometimes been a very big picture. You didn't mention, but he's an ardent political activist on the left, talking about social issues and the fight for justice. Not that he's ever preachy, but he's been focused. And on this album, it's coming from a place of personal, what it is like to be Michael. And on a track like Motherless, and to some extent Slummer, which we bumped in with, I think he's very, very successful. There's that humor. There's that insight. I am a black man who has deep political thoughts, but there's more to me. I am a father. I am a husband. I am a born-again Christian. Very important, all of these things in my life. When he's talking about himself and sharing himself, I think it's wonderful. Occasionally, a few missteps. He can get a little preachy. All of you N-words who are still talking New Jack City, that's why you're all poor, right? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But that comes a couple of lines after bragging about having bought a new BMW.
Mm-hmm.
But in many ways, Mike's willingness to show all the facets of his personality, which includes some that conflict, right? I am a work in progress. I'm trying, people. We all should be trying. In these times, more than ever, is the message that I think that you get throughout. The other way that this album is deeply personal and a surprising musical departure in some ways is the amount of gospel influence here.
Mm.
Grew up with church music, is back in the church. No ID does a fantastic job of painting a rich musical tapestry, soul and funk, and yes, ingredients we expect in hip-hop. But I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, you're the bigger gospel fan. I just love it and respect it, but you know it inside out. I think, one of the most powerful testaments in hip-hop to incorporating those sounds, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole idea of the richness of this production, I think he was looking for something like that in keeping with his evolving views on religion and the role it played in his life. So No ID was a perfect choice. The collaboration with Common really kind of brought out that flavor in Chicago music early in the 90s, and it continued through records with Kanye West and people like that. You saw it as a common theme, Chance the Rapper, etc. And you're seeing it now on this record. And it adds a depth to the production that he has never had before. For example, bringing out the gospel voices, Aaron Allen Kane, who has been making some great records on the Chicago scene in recent years, is all over this record with her voice. CeeLo Green, his cameo on Down by Law, makes that record. Absolutely right about Motherless and Slummers being kind of the emotional high points of this record. It's the most personal record he's ever made. I mean, songs about moms in hip-hop discuss, right?
Right.
There's a litany of them, but, to see that sort of tenderness and vulnerability impressive in a lot of ways, because, you know, the Run the Jewels records were very hardcore, very political. Mm-hmm. Now we're getting sort of the inner. And you're right, there's contradictions to this record. I really think a track like Talking That Blank is one of the low points of his career.
Yeah.
You know, I was shocked to hear the homophobia in this track.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the thing about, just Mike being thin-skinned about criticism that he's gotten about the way he's involved in politics and the kind of life he's leading. Come on, man, you're bigger than that.
He is bigger than that.
But it's a misstep, and this record has some amazing things on it. One other point I'd like to make is that Andre 3000 cameo, he doesn't do cameos for just anybody.
No.
He's been pretty quiet the last couple of years. Here he's out with his old friend Killer Mike on Scientists and Engineers, which if you listen to that track, that is just like one of the weirdest arrangements you could ever possibly imagine. And it somehow works because of these, you know, all these different forces coming together.
Communication coming in. Too much that I can't communicate with all of them. I do wish I had scientist or engineer friends. Let's go. Get out of here, Petro. It's cheaper than it's ever been. And then, who's to say when art will end? All I know is when the portrait painted, better have your portion of the rent. A dollar more and you will get upgraded. When you think you've made it, you are then just tolerated, overrated. Hope I'm 80 when I get my second win. Small potatoes, all I ate before potato chips will cut my corner lips.
So there's some really great stuff on this record, and there's some low points too.
Yeah, but I'm choosing
overall,
to see those.
I'm
choosing to see the low points as Mike admitting I'm a failed human being in many ways, but I'm always working on it.
Yep, absolutely right. And that's what we thought about the latest from Killer Mike. A lot to chew on in this record. And as always, we want to hear from you, our listeners. Leave us a voice message with your thoughts on our website at soundopinions.org. Coming up, we revisit our conversation with Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil on Sound Opinions.
Nobody can tell.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in and inspired by Chicago. They got 312 Wheat Ale, Hazy Beer Hug, and many more one-off beers at the Fulton Street Tap Room or their new Salt Shed Pub. The perfect place to go before a show at the Salt Shed. Me and Andrew were there on opening night, Greg. Mm-hmm. It was really exciting. You had Rocky Mountain spotted fever, tick fever. I'm sorry about that. Anyway, every time we go to one of these Goose joints, there's another new one to try, and we love them all.
I'm a fan. In addition to making great products and event spaces, Goose Island has always been a supporter of music culture in Chicago and nationwide. I mean, if you see that Goose Island logo at a venue or a restaurant, you know you're in good hands.
Yeah, we are proud to be associated with Goose Island. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer, and Sound Opinions is. Sound Opinions is brought to you by NordVPN. NordVPN is the gateway to secure and private access to the internet. We all need that. And it works by enveloping all of your online activities in a layer of encryption while also hiding information about your virtual location. Greg, before I had a VPN, I was sitting in a doctor's waiting room, and boy, did I get hammered with a virus. I mean, I'm going to the doctor and get rid of a virus.
Well, safety from viruses is one of the great uses of NordVPN. It's an incredible tool. It's easy to use. You can connect with just one click and enjoy the amazing speed on every major platform, from Windows to iOS to Android. Now, this summer, I'll be doing some traveling.
You're going overseas.
This is a necessity. You know, you've got to use this. I know I can count on NordVPN to help me easily access secure connections on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere I go. You know, it's easy to get hacked these days, right?
Yep.
This will help. It also makes it easy to access paid subscriptions to streaming services and content, even if it's not available in the country I'm in.
So you can watch your Netflix while you're sunning it in Europe.
Absolutely.
If you want safe access to your favorite streams, social media, and more, no matter where you are, get an exclusive NordVPN deal here at nordvpn.com/soundopinions. nordvpn.com/soundopinions. It's risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee, and the link's in the description of this episode.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. I emphasize partner there, right? Mm-hmm. Because we're going to talk to one of the great songwriting partnerships in the history of popular music. For more than 60 years, Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil wrote some of the most melodic, lyrically deft, and emotionally fulfilling songs of all time, and I think underrated as one of the great Brill-building style teams. Mm-hmm. They never got their due as much as some of the other famous songwriting teams. In addition to maintaining a strong creative partnership, they were married for just as long, and they have a daughter, Jen. We got to meet them through our producer, Matt Spiegel, who was related many years ago, so people may remember Matt's name, they may not. Cynthia passed away at age 82 earlier this year. We could think of no better way to honor her than replaying this fantastic interview with her and her husband from 2011. And Greg, I think this advice about songwriting and the insights into the craft are, you know, as up to the minute today as they would have been, you know, in 2011 or 60 years ago.
Right. Well, I mean, what a team. And they were a delight to talk to, I have to say. They were just such a fun couple. You could tell that there's a reason that this relationship has lasted, not only professionally, but personally. Mm-hmm. They have a real bond. And those songs, the Animals, you know, doing We Gotta Get Out of This Place, which they wrote, the Drifters on Broadway, the Righteous Brothers, You've Lost That Love and Feeling. I mean, and they defined the charts in the 60s and early 70s with those extraordinary songs.
And shaped the direction of popular music.
And those songs continued to be recorded and played today, indicating that these were not just period pieces, but the richness of the arrangements, but also the lyrics, speaking to a world that was evolving and still evolving and still making relevant statements about the world we live in today. So that to me was the takeaway. So let's dive into this conversation because it is definitely worth revisiting.
I was writing with a singer-songwriter named Teddy Randazzo, and Barry came up to play Teddy a song, and I saw him and I was smitten, and I found out where he was signed as a writer, and I arranged to have an appointment with Don Kirshner at Alden Music so that I could see Barry again.
So Alden Music is like right next door to the Brill Building. It's at 1650 Broadway. The Brill Building's like across the street, right?
Well, yeah, it's like a block away.
Okay.
1650 had, at that time, the Young Turks, the publishing companies that had younger writers signed.
Well, so you were writing with somebody else, Cynthia, and you saw this guy, you were smitten.
Yes.
And you wanted to write with him?
Yes. Well, I wanted to date him. I didn't care about writing with him.
That was a polite way of saying she wanted to date me.
Yes.
Right. Wow. You know what blows my mind about this era? You are extremely young when you're working there. I mean, you are writing hit songs and you're like late teens, early 20s, right?
Well, my first hit, I was 19 years old. It was a song called She Say Doobie Doom by the Diamonds.
Yes, sounds like it was written by a four-year-old.
And later on, I did Who Put the Bump.
So, right.
And then I learned how to speak English.
And then you wrote with me.
Right. Who put the bump in the bump, bump, bump? Who put the rhyme in the ram-a-lam-a ding dong? Who put the bop in the bop, shabop, shabop? Who put the dip in the dip, 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 dip? Who was that man? I'd like to shake his hand.
The relationship developed sort of outside of the writing, or would you say that the writing brought the two of you closer together where you ended up being married?
Barry, do you want to take that, or should I?
Yeah, I really think that the writing did bring us closer together. We were attracted to each other, but the writing kind of clinched the deal. I asked to see her lyrics, and I really loved what she had written. She had a style that was very sophisticated, but at the same time, it was very soulful. But she really wasn't familiar with the pop market, and I told her to listen to the Drifter records, and I told her to listen to the Everly Brothers and a lot of R&B records too, and she picked it up very quickly, and she was able to combine that sophistication with soul.
I was writing for another company at the time called Lesser Music, which was owned by Frank Lesser, who wrote How to Succeed in Business and Most Happy Fella. And the writers up there were mostly show writers, and because that's the direction I thought my career would be going.
Yeah, the Broadway thing was very important to you. I know you had some theatrical background. You did some dancing, right, Cynthia? So
right.
How did you end up, quote-unquote, slumming in the pop world?
Well, you know, it's amazing what love and lust will do to your career direction. Barry was in rock and roll, and he taught me rock and roll. And we started writing, and I got a little diverted from the theatrical path.
For about 40 years.
Yeah.
He put the bump in your bump shabomb, right?
He absolutely did. You know, that's a very good way of putting it.
As I've read the story, when you first approached Kirshner thinking you wanted to get your eyes on this cute-looking guy Barry again, they were interested in hiring you, and they wanted to put you with this other songwriter. What's her name? Oh, yeah, Carole King.
Right.
You could have had a completely different career in life.
Well, I don't think it really would have happened because Carol was writing with her husband, Jerry Goffin, and Jerry at the time was a chemist during the day. He was a chemist by day, songwriter by night. Kirshner said, she's not writing with anyone during the day. She should be writing with somebody. So why don't you write with her? So I went out to Carol's apartment in Brooklyn, and she gave me a melody that I really liked. Even I, who did not know pop music, thought this was very hit-sounding. And by the time I got home, my phone was ringing, and it was Carol saying, you know, I know this isn't the right way to start a writing relationship, but Jerry came home from work, and he heard the melody I gave you, and he was very interested in it himself, and I have to ask you for it back.
Wow.
She said, he even has a title. So I said, well, what's the title, you know? And she said, Take Good Care of My Baby. I said, that's a good title, Carol. You know, yeah. I'm giving it back to you.
Take good care of my baby. Please don't ever make her blue. Just tell her that you love her. Make sure you're thinking of her in everything you say and do.
You were successful at a really young age. What's fascinating to me is that there was these stables of songwriters. You know, the Brill Building, you and Alden Publishing. I mean, we're talking about some heavy hitters. Neil Sedaka, Howard Greenfield, you know, King Goffin, yourselves. Barry, describe what a working day was like here with these songwriters around. I mean, were you guys literally like working right next to each other, competing for songs?
Yeah, sometimes. Alden Music had offices where there was a big main room, and on the circumference of the room were these little cubicles. There must have been about five or six. And the cubicles just had like an upright piano, a piano bench, a chair, and an ashtray. Some people would be lucky and they'd have a window, you know. But so a lot of times we would be writing, and Kirshner would say the Drifters are up. So everybody would run to their cubicles and they'd start writing for the Drifters. So you'd hear everybody's melodies through the wall and that kind of stuff.
Everybody in the neighborhood is dressing up to be there too.
But it was a very competitive atmosphere, very competitive, especially between Carol and Jerry and Cynthia and myself. They were the talents, and they felt that way about us. And so it was.
Well, everyone was talented, but they were the other married couple talent, and they were also our closest friends up there.
Yeah, it was very confusing because being that they were our friends, and we really had great times with them, we really loved them, but at the same time, we wanted that next record, and they wanted that next record.
Right. And so it was bad news when we heard they got it, but we'd have to smile and say, great.
You know? Yeah. So a well-natured but nonetheless intense competition like the Beatles and the Stones a couple of years later.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now you got a man who's gonna get you smiling every day. Baby, happy times are here to stay.
Cynthia, Barry, we have to talk about You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling. Recorded by the Righteous Brothers in 1964, it's been honored by BMI as the most performed song of the 20th century, which is really saying something. Take us through that song.
Well, let me start, and Barry, sure. You take over, okay?
Sure.
We had met Phil Spector, and he asked us to come out to California to write with him. So Phil played us a record by these two guys from Orange County, and they were both up-tempo songs that Bill Medley had written. One was called Little Latin Loopy Lou, and the other was called My Babe. And he said, I've just signed these guys, and believe it or not, they're white guys from Orange County, although they sound like Sam and Dave. And we would want to write have you guys write something for them.
And we started, we wrote two verses and a chorus, and we didn't know how to end the chorus. So we called up Phil. We wanted to get his input. And we used the title, You've Lost That Lovely Feeling, as a dummy title. We didn't really like the title. So when we played it for Phil, and when we were done playing, we said to Phil, now, Phil, man, you know, don't worry about the title. We'll get a better title. He says, no, you won't, man. That's the title.
Mm.
We ended up finishing the song. We went over to Phil's place, and we finished the rest of the song. And then the next day, we went up and we played it for Bill and Bobby. So Phil and I sang the song to him. And after we were done, it was dead silence. Then Bill said, well,
No, it's Bobby.
Bill said, sounds good for the Everly Brothers. You know?
Oh, right.
And then Bobby said, well, what am I, you know, because the way the song was set up, it was Bill was singing the verses, and then Bobby would just do harmony on the choruses, and then they'd trade off on the bridge. So when they were done, Bobby says, well, what am I supposed to do? Why, the big guy's singing. And Phil didn't miss a beat. He says, you go to the bank.
You never close your eyes anymore. No tenderness like before in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show it. But baby, baby, I love it.
What's amazing to me is that you were kind of on this made-to-order business, constant deadlines. You had to write on a deadline all the time. And yet you were able to come up with these very, some people could describe that as kind of generic, so universal to the point where I could lose any kind of, you know, personal feeling. And yet you were able to drop these lines in there. Like, I understand that Spector was blown away by the first line of You've Lost That Love and Feeling. Right away, he seemed to sense that you had something there that was above and beyond.
The verses and choruses, I think the line that knocked him out,
Something beautiful's dying. When I sang that line, he said, you know, I feel like crying. I mean, it was a very moving line.
It makes me just feel like crying. Cause baby, something beautiful's dying. You lost that love to me.
We never imagined that it would be the most performed song of the 20th century. It was just something that we liked, and Phil made a magnificent record.
Yeah, and Phil said, you know, this is going to be a very important song for all of us. And Cynthia, being a show baby, you know, a theater kid, said, any song that has whoa, whoa, whoa in it could never be important.
Which shows you how much I know.
How were you able to sort of get that sort of specificity and sort of that personal connection? You know, when you kiss me, you know, you never close your eyes anymore, those kind of things. I mean, it seemed like you were drawing on personal stuff and investing in these universal songs. And I think that's one of the keys to why that song is so well loved over the years.
Well, I have two thoughts about that. I think that really great writers are not just perceptive. I almost feel they're psychic in a way. And they have the capacity to almost become the artist they're writing for. And I think that really is a tremendous advantage. So that's one of the reasons. And I'm forgetting the second reason.
But there's a time in your life when in a creative person's life, when they're very much in tune with the cultural zeitgeist or the universal thought, and can tune into it. And I just kind of felt at that point that anything that I like or anything that I write about is something that other people feel. So some of it was based on personal experience, some of it was based on friends' experience, and some of it was just based on that part of your brain that clicks on when someone says, be creative.
Yeah, I think that even if you're writing for an artist, and you may not have lived that artist's life, but I still think some of your personal experience will go into that lyric or that melody.
No doubt about it. Cynthia, I know that some of the sophistication you are bringing to these pop songs to this day, I think, is striking. I'm thinking of something like Uptown by the Crystals, which I know has been described as almost like one of the first songs that was, you know, sociological, you know, and here we were in the pop heyday. Again, drawing on these very specific kind of vignettes, I mean, were these things that you would observe and then sort of write down? I mean, how would these sort of observations come to you that you would end up incorporating them in lyrics to hit songs?
That was something that I observed. But first, I want to say that I went to a very progressive high school, and everybody was into Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and Hootenannies and that kind of thing. And I saw music as a form of social protest and a form of expressing political views. And so I think I brought a little of that to pop music when I got into pop. With Uptown, I had observed very tall, handsome African-American guy pushing something that, you know, those things that have all the clothes on them in the garment district. And he looked like an African king. And I thought, here he is pushing a clothes rack. What is his life like? And then I wrote that song.
But then he comes uptown each evening to my tenement. Uptown where folks don't have to pay much rent. And when he's there with me, he can see that he's everything. Then he's tall, he don't crawl, he's a king.
When we return, more from Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, and a conversation with Ryan Tedder. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions. Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm/charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, alotrolado.org/volunteer.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
blame it on the bossa nova. When it's magic spell, blame it on the bossa nova that he did so well.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot. He's Jim DeRogatis. This week, we're talking with Barry Mann and the late Cynthia Weil. Let's get back into the conversation.
Mann and Weil have been writing massive pop hits together since the early 60s for artists including Wilson Pickett, The Crystals, and The Drifters. One Drifters tune in particular ended up becoming one of their signature songs, one of the great songs really of the last century, On Broadway. I wanted to know the origins of that tune and how Barry and Cynthia captured the reality of New York City.
Cynthia and I had originally written it for a girls group. Lieber and Stoller weren't involved. And it kind of was the same melody to a large degree. The verses were, they say the neon lights are bright on Broadway. They say there's always magic in the air. But anyway, it was about the girls group who wanted to get out of town and get to Broadway. Mm. Nothing happened with that version, by the way.
But it was recorded. Phil Spector recorded it.
Yeah, and Carol and Jerry cut it with the cookies.
Cookies.
I hear the neon lights are bright on Broadway.
Then we heard that Jerry and Mike were about to go in and record The Drifters. So we thought, well, why don't we just go play that for them and see what happens? So we played it for them, and they really liked it a lot, but they felt that it needed a rewrite. And so they gave us a choice to either we could rewrite it ourselves or rewrite it with them. And so Cynthia and I jumped at the chance to rewrite it with Lieber and Stoller, because if we idolized anyone, it was them. Then all of us together rewrote it, and it became what it is today. Much better song, even though
a great lesson in songwriting.
Oh yeah, I mean it was amazing to watch the way Jerry and Mike worked, especially Jerry, the way he threw lines out at you, and if he got stuck, he said, "Well, let's go on to the next verse, and we'll come back to this." And Cynthia, being basically an obsessive lyricist, she always felt that you have to finish the verse and then go to the chorus and go back to the next verse.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a lesson for her.
What about the cinematic quality of these songs? I mean, you know, we talked about You've Lost That Love and Feeling. I mean, obviously that was Spector. Lieber Stoller with On Broadway. How much of that was sort of envisioned by the way you put the music together, Barry? I mean, was it sort of like inherent in the demos or in your instructions to the producers and the performers about the way you wanted a thing to sound, or did you sort of hand it off to them and say, do whatever you want with it?
Yeah, I basically handed it off, but, you know, friends or musician friends of mine always said that with the way I played piano as if the whole arrangement was in my piano playing. And to a degree, they're right.
Also, Barry's vocal interpretation was often absorbed by the artist. And a lot of people will say, you know, I can hear you in the other artists that sing your songs.
That's quite a tribute. Would it be a case where that they would come to you as they were recording and ask for tips? Or would you actually be observing a lot of the recording process?
No, no. Phil Spector took, I think I gave him a piano voice demo.
Yeah, Barry did put the vocal down.
Yeah.
And in most cases, I don't think it happened on Broadway, but in most cases there was a demo, and whether it was elaborate, where Barry kind of laid out how he wanted the record to sound, or whether it was just a piano vocal with him, there was always that Barry Mann quality of how a lyric is read that other people picked up on.
We're talking to songwriters Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil on Sound Opinions. I want to ask you both about We Gotta Get Out of This Place. Again, we come back to that universality, whether it's the Animals singing about breaking out of industrial England or you in your own lives feeling stuck. How did that song come together?
We originally wrote the song for the Righteous Brothers, and Barry cut an elaborate, fabulous demo. And when it was done, everybody was saying, my God, this sounds like a record. We, at the time, were involved with Alan Klein, who later managed the Stones and the Beatles, but at that point, he was managing some other people. After the demo, I think we were excited about it. We went up to his office, and we played it for him, and then we left the demo there for some reason and forgot.
And I was on Redbird Records at the time.
Then we played a copy for Redbird, and they said, we want to put this out as a single. In the meantime, we didn't know Alan Klein had sent it to a client of his named Mickey Most to cut the Animals. And so just as Barry's record was set to come out, we got a call from Kirshner saying, I've got great news. You've got a song that's number two in England. And we said, oh, what song? And he said, we got to get out of this place. And we said, no. Oh, my God, no. Well, it's the first time songwriters ever screamed no when someone told them they had a hit. But that killed Barry's record.
What did you think of the Animals version when you eventually heard it?
I laughed because it was a shock. It was truly a shock. They had left out an awful lot of the lyric. And
substituted their own. And then they repeated the same lyric.
Yeah, for the first and second verse, which, you know, as a songwriter, I just felt wasn't craft. And and had they asked me to change it, for them, maybe I wouldn't have because of Barry's record, but at least I would have had a chance to write something that I felt proud of. So I was kind of upset. And to this day, I think every time we run into Eric Burdon, we both kind of look the other way because he knew I was upset, you know.
Watch my daddy in bed at time. Watch his hair.
His performance is amazing. The record, for what it is amazing. And it went on to have so much meaning for so many people in the Vietnam War that, I mean, Eric, all is forgiven. Let's be friends and let's look each other in the eye next time we meet.
As songwriters, I imagine you guys sometimes have to subsume your egos. You create this thing that you're really proud of. Then it goes off, and it's not under your control anymore. Sometimes your baby comes back, and I bet you hardly recognize it.
Normally, as a songwriter, it's kind of, as Barry often says, it's the job we chose for ourselves.
This is the business we chose.
Yeah, and so it goes with the territory. You write something, and you're proud of it, and you love it, and you're walking in the supermarket, and you hear someone saying, and this is, you know, so-and-so's, with the title of the song, and you want to say, I wrote that, that's mine, but that's not what the job is. The job is to serve the artist.
We could do this for hours. It's been a real honor having you guys on, so thank you so much.
Great. Thank you. It's been fun for us, too.
That was Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, the prolific songwriting duo responsible for some of the biggest hits of all time.
I got my mind made up, man, I can't let go. I'm killing every second till it sings my soul. I've been running till the loving's out.
Now we're going to talk with a more contemporary hit-making songwriter, Ryan Tedder. He's probably best known for being the front man of the pop rock band One Republic, but he's also an extremely successful hired songwriter. And he's written mega hits for Beyonce, Adele, Taylor Swift, people like that. Tedder struggled as a songwriter in Nashville before catching a break in the mid-2000s, and he's maintained his dual roles as both a performer and a songwriter ever since. Ryan Tedder joins us today to talk about his experience writing for artists other than himself and how he creates memorable pop songs. Ryan, welcome to Sound Opinions.
Thanks for having me.
So in the early 2000s, when you were just starting out, you worked for the hit music producer Timbaland, who's collaborated with everyone from Missy Elliott to Justin Timberlake. Then after a couple of years, you guys go your separate ways. But when you form One Republic, Timbaland comes back into your life. Tell us about that.
Turns out Timbaland had gotten a record label imprint on Interscope, and I randomly get a call from Timbaland saying, "Hey, I heard your Apologize record on MySpace. I think it's a number one record. I'm obsessed with it. I'd like to remix it, put it on my album." So we signed with Interscope via Timbaland. It's been, at this point, 2 years since I'd even talked to the guy. And he comes back into my life, signs us, Apologize gets remixed. It was never supposed to come out as a remix. And you couldn't stop it. Once his album came out, it was the top-selling song on the album, and it became the biggest hit he ever had and our first number one.
It's too late to apologize.
How do you make that transition from struggling artists to writing songs for these giant acts? Would you trace it back to something like Apologize as, oh, I want to work with the guy who wrote that song? Or what would you attribute the fact that you had this second career as a producer and songwriter going?
The fact that they took off at the same time, my writing producing career and my artist career, is complete happenstance. Nobody plans that. MySpace exploded alongside with us exploding live. All of a sudden, we were selling out venues in LA. You would play the Avalon. I got two phone calls. One was from Simon Cowell, and the other phone call was from one of Natasha Bedingfield's people. I had a hit record with her called Love Like This. And the call from Simon was, "Ryan, congratulations. You know, so happy for you. We've decided to make Bleeding Love the first single on Leona Lewis." So that all happened on the same day. He's like, "Congrats, you've got Leona's first single." And then I got another call saying, "Congrats, you've got Natasha Bedingfield's first single." And then we got offered a record deal. So, you know, when it rains, it pours.
You cut me open and I keep bleeding, keep bleeding love. I keep bleeding, I keep bleeding love. Keep bleeding, keep bleeding love. You cut me open.
So how did you start writing songs for Beyoncé?
The first One Republic album, Beyoncé picked up, and she fell in love with an album cut off of that album, like track 10 or 12 or whatever. She randomly called me out of the blue one day and said, "I want you to write a song for my next album," and that turned out to be Halo.
So Halo, I mean, you know, she's still closing her concerts with Halo. It's like,
yeah,
one of the biggest songs of her life.
I
want you to sort of take us through writing a song with Beyoncé, because there's a couple questions I have. First of all, your role in that, I imagine, was huge. You know, she's calling you for a reason. But secondly, there's also the question, well, how much input does Beyoncé really have in her music? Is she sort of like an editor, or is she working with you head-to-head, or how did it work with writing a song like Halo, which is a signature song for her?
Yeah, so it's evolved. That came out, I want to say, like, it was spring, summer 2009, I think, is when it came out. Her involvement has evolved in the last 7 years. Now she's highly involved as a topliner, a lyricist. Halo was more, I don't want to say a commissioned piece, but that's kind of what it was. Mm-hmm. It was, "I like what you do. Send me a song. Done. Send me a completed song." But Halo was done, written with me and a friend of mine, Evan Bogart. So he came over, and 3 hours later, he left, and Halo had been written. And the only thing that was missing was the bridge, which I did the next day. And incidentally, was the only part of the song she changed. There was an original middle eight section that's a kind of a piano solo section. And what she did, which I thought was physically impossible, was take my crazy piano arpeggio melody, and she sang it. So when you hear her singing in the bridge, just doing that melody, she's mimicking what the piano was doing.
And that makes sense. You're just starting out. You're an unknown quantity. You're just sending tracks. Something connects with the artist. You aren't even in the same room with her throughout the crafting of Halo. But now, does she give you a ring and you go over to the place, you know, and you sit side by side on the piano, she's in her sweats? I mean, is that how it is now, or is that how it is with Adele?
I would say that is more how it is now, in my experience with her, than it's ever been. But she, at this point, is at that stage where she can literally do what she wants with or without radio support. There's very, very few finite instances where an artist themselves becomes the hit and the song no longer needs to be the hit, if that makes sense. And the only two artists I can think of in that realm right now are Adele and Beyonce. You know what I mean? It's like they are the hit. They trump the song.
And it seems like with Adele, Adele has always sort of prided herself in being a songwriter. And I'm wondering, was the role, the function that you played in collaborating with her, different than the way it was with Beyonce when your relationship started?
Yeah, different. Adele is more the more typical experience I've had, except that her talent is so not typical. 21 was different than 25. On 21, you know, I was a fan of 19. We ran into each other randomly in a hotel elevator after the Grammys a few years back, and said, "Hey, I'd love to work with you." I said, "Me too. Here's my number." Ditto. 1 month later, we do Turning Tables in London. Yeah, I got lucky. You know, I knew she was going through some difficult situations, so I always try to get in the frame of mind of the artist I'm in the room with. You know, when I'm in writer producer mode, I'm no longer the lead singer of One Republic. Any amount of stars in your eyes goes out the window, and you're there to service the artist. I mean, you're 100% there to service the song, which in turn services the artist.
You know, some of your favorite acts growing up, the people that made you make music, are Peter Gabriel and The Police and The Beatles and Stevie Wonder. They didn't have songwriting help. You know, Beyonce is clearly an interpreter in the great pop tradition. But, you know, Adele, Taylor Swift, why do they need help? Why shouldn't I hear something that comes from them alone in the acoustic guitar?
It's like, why are there four, sometimes nine writers on this? I mean, Kanye, 16 writers on a song.
Yeah.
Why does this happen? Before the late 90s, early 2000s, writers were writers. Some artists were writers, some weren't. There's a Mason-Dixon line between writing and producing. What qualified as publishing ownership of a song or production ownership of a song? The tracks have become so complex that it, on some modern records, you've got two or three guys alone working just on the track. Every single guitar note, every drum pitched and tuned to match the guitars and piano. And then you have the two people who are helping the artist write the lyric and melody. So there, before you know it, you've got five, six people on one song.
Taylor Swift can sit alone in her bedroom with her guitar, all right? And the genius of Taylor Swift is there. How does the committee make her better?
I will say this. No artist I've ever written with in my career has contributed more of the actual song than Taylor Swift to a writing session. Taylor contributed so much so quickly that for the first time and only time, I actually felt bad for my share. I was like, God, I don't even know if I earned what I did. She'll send you a voice memo the night before saying, "So I just sat down and I was thinking," and she's literally talking on the voice memo like this, "and I was thinking maybe something kind of like this. Welcome to New York. It's been waiting for you." You know, she literally goes into the song and I'm like, I write back, "What do you mean something like? Like that's the whole song." Like, "Welcome to New York. But here's the difference. Taylor is not going to sit down in a studio packed with gear and spend 5 hours dialing in the synthesizer sound that's the lead of the song. She's not going to suggest, maybe we should add a new chord in the bridge, go to the minor third and switch it up a little bit. That's the production. And those are the things that in a modern era, if you don't nail that, if you don't nail the sounds of the song as much as the lyric and the melody, the song's not going to fly.
Ryan, do you think we lose some of the humanity? when yes. something like that is happening. You know, you listen to a Billie Holiday record from the yep. 30s and it still sounds yep. great. What's a generation or three, four generations down the road going to think of this music? Will it hold up? Because it's sort of sapped out some of the humanity. I don't know.
That's the million-dollar question. I absolutely believe that humanity gets lost. I have serious doubts about the classical nature or longevity of most records being made today. We're in a almost what maybe could be the equivalent of the disco era, in which, yeah, one or two songs will survive, pun intended. The vast majority are here today, gone tomorrow, but we now live in a consumption market mm-hmm. where that doesn't really matter as much. Most of my peers aren't sitting around thinking about on those terms anymore. It literally doesn't matter. The classical nature of these records isn't what's driving these people. They're more like, I just want something new. And mm-hmm. then when I'm done with that, I want something else new. And guess what I want after that? I want something else new.
We've been talking to Ryan Tedder. We could talk music to you all day. It's been a real treat, Ryan.
Likewise. Thanks for having me. I'm just doing
what we're told. That wraps up our discussion on great songwriting, and now we want to hear from you. Who's your favorite songwriter? Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Mr. Cott, what is on the show next week?
Well, Jim, we are nearing the midway point of the year, and that means a list. Lists
yes.
from both of us about the records so far that are in our mid-year top 10. And don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm glad other people like lists as much as us, Greg. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.